This is podcast number 187 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today's topic is Harriet Beecher Stowe. It's been a while since I've done a podcast. I've been working hard to finish up the Well-Educated Heart Learning Library. I've been presenting everything through audios, and I've had a number of requests to offer it in writing, so I've been compiling and sorting and compressing everything I've ever said in podcasts, presentations, and other places into 3 volumes. It will be called Catch the Vision of the Well-Educated Heart, and Volume 1 will cover the philosophy. Volume 2 will talk about methods and tools and will include the Take 5s. And Volume 3 will be called Inspiration, which is where I've arranged the podcasts of great lives according to the rotation schedule. That one may have to be broken down into 2 volumes. I want you to be able to pick up the book. I hope this reference library will be helpful to you. The final part I'm finishing up now is a little intro book that can be shared with friends who are wondering what this is all about. In the process of finalizing Volume 3, I discovered I had all the notes for a podcast on Harriet Beecher Stowe, but I never, for some reason, got around to putting it together and recording it. As I went through it, I realized how many well-educated heart principles you can learn from her life. So I thought it would be a perfect story to share as you gear up for the new school year. So let's take a look at Harriet Beecher Stowe. President Abraham Lincoln was sitting by the fireplace in his office when Harriet Beecher Stowe entered the room with her 12-year-old son and her grown daughter. The object of her visit was to deliver an affectionate and Christian address, which had been signed by 500,000 women in Great Britain and Ireland, by duchesses, countesses, wives of generals and ambassadors, as well as by hands that evidently were unused to holding the pen. This address had been sent to their sisters, the women of the United States of America, through Harriet Beecher Stowe in her efforts to remove slavery from the Christian world. In part, it read, "We acknowledge with grief and shame our heavy share in this great sin. We acknowledge that our fathers introduced, nay, even compelled the adoption of slavery in those mighty colonies. We humbly confess it before Almighty God. And it is because we so deeply feel and unfeignedly avow our own complicity that we now venture to implore your aid to wipe away our common crime and our common dishonor." Upon seeing Harriet, Mr. Lincoln quickly rose from his chair. "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that made this great war?" She replied, "I did not write it, not I myself alone. It seemed to me that God himself made me write it, that I wrote it at his dictation." The book was Uncle Tom's Cabin. Slavery had been a subject of debate for decades, but Harriet finally gave eyes to see and hearts to feel the horrors of the institution and stirred the hearts of the people to do something about it. Let me share excerpts from a biography of Harriet Beecher Stowe written by her son, Charles Edward Stowe. Harriet had established herself as a writer when her brother, Edward's wife, wrote her, "Hattie, if I could use a pen as you have, I would write something to make this whole nation feel what an accursed thing slavery is." Harriet replied, "I will write something." Uncle Tom's Cabin came from the heart rather than the head. It was an outburst of deep feeling, a cry in the darkness. The writer no more thought of style or literary excellence than the mother who rushes into the street and cries for help to save her children from a burning house thinks of the teachings of the rhetorician or the elocutionist. It was in the month of February that Mrs. Stowe was seated at communion service in the college church at Brunswick. Suddenly, like the unrolling of a picture, the scene of the death of Uncle Tom passed before her mind. So strongly was she affected that it was with difficulty she could keep from weeping aloud. Immediately on returning home, she took pen and paper and wrote out the vision which had been, as it were, blown into her mind as by the rushing of a mighty wind. Gathering her family about her, she read what she had written. Her 2 little ones of 10 and 12 years of age broke into convulsions of weeping, one of them saying through his sobs, Oh, Mama, slavery is the most cruel thing in the world. Thus, Uncle Tom was ushered into the world, and it was a cry, an immediate, an involuntary expression of deep, impassioned feeling. 25 years afterwards, Mrs. Stowe wrote a letter to one of her children of this period of her life. I well remember the winter you were a baby and I was riding Uncle Tom's cabin. My heart was bursting with the anguish excited by the cruelty and injustice our nation was showing to the slave, and praying God to let me do a little and to cause my cry for them to be heard. I remember many a night weeping over you as you lay sleeping beside me, and I thought of the slave mother whose babes were torn from them. Uncle Tom's cabin made the enforcement of the fugitive slave law an impossibility. It aroused the public sentiment of the world by arousing in the concrete that which had been a mere series of abstract propositions. People are like children and understand pictures better than words. So Uncle Tom's cabin made the crack of the slave driver's whip and the tortured blacks ring in every household in the land till human hearts could endure it no longer. I could not control the story. It wrote itself. I, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin? No, indeed. The Lord himself wrote it, and I was but the humblest instrument in his hand. To him alone should be given all the praise. There's so much in this biography of this wonderful woman I wish I could share. Do yourself a favor and find a copy in Internet Archive. It's called The Life of Harriet Beecher Stowe by Charles Stowe. In the meantime, let's take a couple of snapshots of the childhood that produced the writer. Although her mother died when just 5 years old, there was a bond between her that influenced all Harriet's life and is revealed in nearly everything she wrote. Her father believed thoroughly in playtime, and when long or hard tasks were well done, he often rewarded the small workers with a fishing trip or nut gathering. The pleasure seekers tramped happily away at daybreak for a holiday that often lasted until after dark. He was better known as a playmate than a disciplinarian. He possessed a stimulating personality that always brought forth the best efforts of his large brood in whatever task they undertook, and he tried to make those tasks so interesting that no one would want to shirk. If tasks were indoors, one of them would read Scott's novels or some other interesting work, while the rest busied themselves with their hands, and the long evenings slipped by so rapidly that no one could believe bedtime was at hand when the old clock struck the hour. Even when sawing hickory logs, they strengthened their minds debating some topic suggested by their father. Often he would purposely take the wrong side of a question in order to create a lively argument. Thus he developed their reasoning powers to an unusual degree, making strong speakers of his children, and in this manner fitting them to become the powerful creatures which six of them afterward became. He loved music, and they had quite a respectable orchestra under their own roof. The Beecher children lacked toys, but the lack was not greatly felt, for all of the little Beechers possessed vivid imaginations and could readily think up new games. They never lacked for rag dolls with real painted faces and clothes to dress them in. The children almost lived in the open air. There were gardens to tend to, especially flower gardens with hollyhocks and marigolds. The wild beauty of the place held the child enthralled even before she could tell what it was that seemed so beautiful about her surroundings. She would sit on the stone parsonage steps and watched the glorious sunsets fade into purple twilights, too deeply moved for tears. The day started with an early breakfast, simple but hearty. Family prayers followed breakfast, and every member of the household took part. So impressive were these brief morning services that they were never forgotten by any of them. Long evenings were given to family discussions or household tasks. Then family prayers were held again, and good night spoken. Her little town was visited by many of the chief revolutionary heroes of the time, and the stories were repeated. She heard many stories of those stirring times which stirred her heart with patriotism. There were also stories of her mother, and stories from her uncle who brought home wonderful treasures from around the world and told tales of adventure of his trips around the world as a sea captain, all made impressions never to be forgotten by the sensitive child. She loved her father's study and the books that lined the walls. She says, "High above all the noise of the house, this room had to me the air of a refuge and sanctuary. Its walls were set round from floor to ceiling with the friendly, quiet faces of books. And there stood my father's great writing chair, on one arm of which lay open his Bible. Here I loved to retreat and niche myself in a quiet corner with my favorite books around me. I had a kind of sheltered feeling as I sat and watched my father writing, turning to his books and speaking from time to time to himself in a loud, earnest whisper. I vaguely felt that he was about some holy and mysterious work quite beyond my little comprehension, and I was careful never to disturb him by question or remark. She dug up The Tempest and Arabian Nights. Her delight knew no bounds. She read Ivanhoe 7 times in one summer. They weren't content to just read them. They must play them out, discuss them with their friends, and compare their merits and faults with those of other books which they had read. They acted out many of the scenes with simple costumes put together." She wrote, "I was married when I was 25 years of age to a man rich in Greek and Hebrew, Latin and Arabic, and also rich in nothing else. The first year, twin daughters were born while her husband was away in England. 5 more babies arrived quickly after that. She always declared that she would never exchange her children for all the ease, leisure, and pleasure she could have had without them. She said, 'God invented mothers' hearts, and he certainly has the pattern in his own.' Her children received much of their early education under her. She said, 'The most fearful thing about this education matter is that it is example more than word. Talk as you will, the child follows what he sees, not what he hears. The prevailing tone of the parent's character will make the temper of the household. The spirit of the parent will form the spirit of the child.' With this thought uppermost in her heart, she succeeded in making the atmosphere of her home sweet, harmonious, and happy, and between the members of her family existed a bond of understanding that is rarely found. Harriet became a musician and artist of considerable ability and had a positive genius for homemaking. She was well-read and spoke French fluently and did beautiful needlework and lace. When problems of any sort arose about homemaking duties, she promptly went to the encyclopedia for advice and studied until she solved the problem. She built her own Russian stove according to the description seen in an encyclopedia, and it heated 6 rooms more efficiently on less fuel it took for a single fire in an open fireplace. One time she made a carpet out of a bale of cotton her husband brought home, which was unheard of at that time. The church deacons chided Mrs. Beecher for trying to make the house so splendid that heaven would lose its attractiveness. There was never enough money, and her husband was often gone. Some of you might relate to this letter to her husband. 'My dear husband, it is a dark, sloppy, rainy, muddy, disagreeable day, and I have been working hard, for me, all day in the kitchen, washing dishes, looking into closets, and seeing a great deal of that dark side of domestic life. I am sick of the smell of sour milk and sour meat and sour everything, and then the clothes will not dry, and no wet thing does. And everything smells moldy, and altogether I feel as if I never want to eat again. I feel no life, no energy, no appetite, or rather a growing distaste for food. I suffer with sensible distress in the brain, a distress which some days takes from me all power of planning or executing anything. And you know that, except for this poor head, my unfortunate household has no mainspring, for nobody feels any kind of responsible to do a thing in time, place, or manner, except as I oversee it." Her husband was very dependent on her and pessimistic by nature, and she had to cheer him on when he became downhearted. If you were not already my dearly beloved husband, I should certainly fall in love with you. But with her unswerving faith in her God, she bore her burdens bravely. Another time it fell on her to move to Brunswick, Maine. There was furniture to be bought, a house to be found and put in order, in the midst of a cold northeastern storm that continued for days. She found many of her adventures funny and laughed heartily over them with family and friends. The kitchen had no sink, so she solved the problem and created one herself. She finished the house the 1st of July, gave birth to their 7th child on July 8th. Yet she still managed to teach school an hour a day to her children and read to them for 2 hours every evening while her husband was away. In spite of the numberless tasks that absorbed her time, night and day, she found time to keep at her writing through all these years. Or perhaps it would be better to say that she made the time, for she certainly learned to do several things at once, and in this way managed her stories when a less determined or a less talented soul would have given up in despair. An amusing and at the same time most interesting account of her struggles to accomplish literary work amid her distracting domestic duties is furnished by the letter of one of her intimate friends, who writes, "It was my good fortune to number Mrs. Stowe among my friends, and during a visit to her I had an opportunity one day of witnessing the combined exercise of her literary and domestic genius in a style that, to me, was quite amusing. 'Come, Harriet,' said I, as I found her tending one baby and watching two others just able to walk, 'where is that piece for the souvenir which I promised the editor I would get from you and send on next week? You have only this day to finish it, and have it I must.' 'And how will you get it, friend of mine?' said Harriet. 'You will at least have to wait till I get a house cleaning over and baby's teeth through.' 'As to house cleaning, you can defer it one day longer, and as to baby's teeth, there is to be no end to them as I can see. No, no, today that story must be ended. There, Frederick has been sitting by Ellen and saying all those pretty things for more than a month now, and she has been turning and blushing till I am sure it is time to go to her relief. Come, it will not take you 3 hours at the rate you can write to finish the courtship, marriage, catastrophe, and all. And this 3 hours' labor of your brains will earn enough to pay for all the sewing your fingers could do for a year to come. $2 a page, my dear, and you can write a page in 15 minutes. Come then, my lady housekeeper. Economy is a cardinal virtue. Consider the economy of the thing." "But, my dear, here is a baby in my arms, and there is great baking down in the kitchen, and there's a new girl for help, besides preparations to be made for house cleaning next week. It is really out of the question, you see." "I see no such thing. I do not know what genius is given for, if it is not to help a woman out of a scrape. Come, set your wits to work. Let me have my way, and you shall have all the work done and finish the story, too." "Well, but kitchen affairs?" "We can manage them too. You know you can write anywhere and anyhow. Just take your seat at the kitchen table with your writing weapons, and while you superintend Mina, fill up the odd snatches of time with the labors of your pen." I carried my point. In 10 minutes she was seated, a table with flour, rolling pin, ginger, and lard on one side, a dresser with eggs, pork, and beans, and various cooking utensils on the other, near her an oven heating, and beside her Mina waiting orders. "Here, Harriet," said I, "you can write on this atlas in your lap. No matter how the writing looks, I will copy it." "Well, well," said she with a resigned sort of amused look. "Mina, you may do what I told you while I write a few minutes, till it is time to mold up the bread. Where is the inkstand?" "Here it is, close by, on the top of the tea kettle," said I. At this Mina giggled, and we both laughed to see her merriment at our literary proceedings. She fell into a muse as she attempted to recover the thread of her story. "Ma'am, shall I put the pork on the top of the beans?" asked Mina. "Come, come," said Harriet, laughing. "You see how it is. Mina is a new hand and cannot do anything without me to direct her. We must give up writing for today." No, no, let us have another trial. You can dictate as easily as you can write. Come, I can set the baby in this clothes basket and give him some mischief or other to keep him quiet. You shall dictate, and I will write. Now, this is the place where you left off. You were describing the scene between Ellen and her lover. The last sentence was, "Borne down the tide of agony, she leaned her head on her hands, the tears streamed through her fingers, and her whole frame shook with convulsive sobs. What shall I write next?" "Mina, pour a little milk into this pearlash," said Harriet. "Come," said I. "The tears streamed through her fingers, and her whole frame shook with convulsive sobs. What's next?" Harriet paused and looked musingly out of the window as she turned her mind to her story. "You may write now," said she, and she dictated as follows. Her lover wept with her, nor dared he again to touch the point so sacredly guarded. "Mina, roll that crust a little thinner." He spoke in soothing tones. "Mina, poke the coals in the oven." "Here," said I, "let me direct Mina about these matters, and write a while yourself." Harriet took the pen and patiently set herself to the work. For a while, my culinary knowledge and skill were proof to all Mina's investigating inquiries, and they did not fail till I saw 2 pages completed. "You have done bravely," said I, as I read over the manuscript. "Now you must direct Mina a while. Meanwhile, dictate, and I will write." Never was there a more docile literary lady than my friend. Without a word of objection, she followed my request. "I'm ready to write," said I. The last sentence was, "What is this life to one who has suffered as I have? What next?" "Shall I put in the brown or the white bread first?" said Mina. "The brown first," said Harriet. "What is this life to one who has suffered as I have?" said I. Harriet brushed the flour off her apron and sat down in a moment in a muse. Then she dictates as follows. "Under the breaking of my heart I have borne up. I have borne up under all that tries a woman, but this thought, oh, Henry." "Ma'am, shall I put ginger into the pumpkin?" queried Mina. "No, you may leave that alone just now," replied Harriet. She then proceeded. "I know my duty to my children. I see the hour must come. You must take them away, Henry. They are my last earthly comfort." "Ma'am, what shall I do with these eggshells and all this truck here?" interrupted Mina. "Put them in the pail by you," answered Harriet. "They are my last earthly comfort," said I. "What next?" She continued to dictate. "You must take them away. It may be, perhaps it must be, that I shall soon follow, but the breaking heart of a wife still pleads a little longer, a little longer." "How much longer must the gingerbread stay in?" inquired Mina. 5 minutes, said Harriet. "A little longer, a little longer," I repeated in a dolorous tone, and we burst into a laugh. Thus we went on, cooking, writing, nursing, and laughing, till I finally accomplished my object. The piece was finished, copied, and the next day sent to the editor. Harriet wrote, "I thank God that there is one thing running through my life from the time I was 13 years old. It is the intense, unwavering sense of God's educative presence and care. Jesus was the friend and comforter whom she had always sought. She could love him with all her heart and soul. She had no further need of worry. Jesus would take care. He really would. He would take care of Hattie Beecher because he loved her. He would give her life beauty and meaning." The day these truths unfolded to her soul, she walked home in a state of exaltation. Treading upon rarefied air, she felt one with life's mysteries. Jesus had taught her. As she shared her experience with her father, he held Hattie close to him. "Then has a new flower blossomed in the kingdom this day." When Harriet finished Uncle Tom's Cabin, she wondered if anyone would ever read what she had written. She had looked for neither fame nor money, but overnight she went from a modest, retiring little mother one day to the author of the world's bestseller. 3,000 copies were sold the first day the book appeared on the market, and over 300,000 copies in a year. By 1857, over 2 million copies had been sold worldwide. And we know the rest of the story. Bye-bye. See you next time.